This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space, a monthly podcast of artist talks, panel discussions, and other events.
Tēnā tātou katoa. Nau mai hoki mai ki tēnei kaupapa kōrero or the Physics Room. Nau mai, whakarongo mai, whakatau mai. My name is Abby Kinane and I'm the director of the Physics Room, a contemporary art space dedicated to developing and promoting contemporary art and critical discourse in Aotearoa. Based in central Ōtautahi since 1996, we assist artists with resources and opportunities to enable creative and professional development and work to support the acknowledgement and understanding of contemporary art among New Zealanders. Our goal is to actively seek links between the arts and other areas of cultural production and to involve art as a contributing voice in wider intellectual, social, and political debate.
Kia ora koutou. My name is Orissa Keane, and I am the Writing and Publications Coordinator at the Physics Room. Welcome to episode 53 of Art Not Science. In this episode, we'll be sharing readings from Correspondence Issue 2.2. Correspondence is a biannual tabloid, publishing pairs of works for the page, web, and air as openings into artistic practices and relationships. Issue 2.2 includes audio and print contributions from Lucy Mail and Ziggy Lever, Millie Godfrey, Balamohan Chingade and Nkosi Nkululeko, Marie Shannon and Albert L. Rafferty. In this episode, you'll hear me read the editorial, which introduces the themes of this issue, followed by Lucy Mail reading Particle Images, Millie Godfrey reading Breathing Room, and Albert L. Rafferty reading Being Social, the context in which the VAR has to embed itself. We hope you'll be able to pick up a print copy from one of our distribution points, which include the Physics Room in Ōtautahi, Blue Oyster Art Project Space in Ōtepoti, Enjoy Contemporary Art Space in Te Whanganui Atara, Samoa House Library in Tamaki Makaurau. You can also enjoy this issue by downloading the full PDF from our website, by listening using your screen reader, and continuing to listen to this episode of Art Not Science. Correspondence is a biannual publication exploring the possibilities of art writing in Aotearoa. This volume, containing issues 2.1 and 2.2, have been informed by the idea of a spacious atrium. For me, the spacious atrium came to represent a kind of breathing room between other spaces in which to explore ideas within my writing practice. For the invited writers, the metaphor was interpreted differently. It could be said that a collective structure was formed between these interpretations. Find yourself a back copy of Correspondence 2.1 to read more about corridors, sun traps, and geospatial dashboards. Correspondence 2.2 returns once more to the spacious atrium, stretching its boundary towards the sky and to Aachen. Both distance and connection can be felt within many of the contributions within this issue. Connections between correspondence, between subjects in the diaspora, between dislocated image fragments, and between the artists and their kites. Interspersed throughout this issue, you'll find stills from Marie Shannon's moving image work, The Aachen Faxes, 2012. The work takes its content from the correspondence Julian Dashper sent, mostly by fax, to his partner Marie Shannon during a residency in Aachen, Germany, in 1995. Within the text-based artwork, recurring references to weather and time emphasize the distance between Dashper and Shannon, between Germany and New Zealand. Despite the relative speed of fax machines in the 1990s, only taking minutes rather than the weeks of waiting for a letter to arrive in the post, the Aachen Faxes captures the presence of longing across distances, something which the faster correspondence of today still fails to erase. The selection of stills in this issue were chosen with these things in mind: time, geographical distance, and the weather. I encourage you to experience the original moving image work, which can be found on the Circuit Artist Moving Image website, with the slow drawn tones of a cello which comprise the soundtrack. Thank you, Marie Shannon, for permission to publish these stills. I've never spent so long considering the possible expenses travelled by images in both their printed and unprinted lost toner forms. I've also never come across such a poetic and interesting description of the movements of toner and paper within a copy printer than in Lucy Mail's contribution, Particle Images. Mail explores image and particle distribution, referencing and expanding on Ziggy Lever's image after Imago from Correspondence 2.1. She describes how some of the fine toner evades thermal adhesion to paper and becomes like pollen or dust in their ability to wander on the air or hitch a ride on a trouser hem. On an utterly windless, sunny day in April, I went with Millie Godfrey to fly a kite at Waimairi Beach for the Aerodynamicas project organised by Millie Janetas and Nicola Farquhar, joined by many other friends and artists. Those who couldn't be there on the day sent kites in their stead, including art contributors Lucy Mill and Ziggy Lever. Godfrey's lyrical account of the day captures the lightness of letting go, running shoes off along the beach, with a falling kite trailing behind. Precisely, I think, what the project set out to achieve. Being Social, the context in which the VAR has to embed itself, is an extract from Albert Raffiti's doctoral thesis, which considers the concept of VAR in the context of the Samoan diaspora. As you'll read, in its traditional Samoan setting, VAR is the organizing principle in which things are given their place and relations are forged between people, as well as between people and objects, and space and territory. And so I return again to thinking about distance and the persistent connections between people and places. Adjournments in chess are no longer so common as they were before shorter time controls were introduced around the 1990s. Previously, a game might go on for 5 or 6 hours, at which point a player would call an adjournment so as to continue the game another time. While Balamor Hunching Guardian and Kozi and Kululeko's game of correspondence chess has spanned a period of 8 months, an end has not been reached and an adjournment has been called for. Correspondence Game 2022-2023, Part 2, Adjournment, continues the epistolary email exchanges of two friends, sharing chess gossip, music recommendations, and stories. Next, you will hear Lucy Mail reading her contribution, Particle Images.
Some weeks ago, I was trying to explain the studio photocopier to a group of students. This was intended to demystify a basic printing process and help them to explore new types of paper and surface, but also to encourage them to clear their own paper jams, rather than letting the communal machine flail for hours, with its little red error light blinking hopefully. Saving the electrostatic and photoconductivity details for another time, I started by describing the path that a piece of paper takes through the machine. From the flat stack in the slide-out tray, the paper moves through a series of rollers, bending and curving around them. Fine, dry toner is applied, in sequence if the intended transfer is in colour, and then warmed and pressed to melt and fuse the particles onto the surface. If the paper is to be printed double-sided, it goes through this process twice, briefly popping out from the machine, only to be sucked back in and reappear somewhere else. When finished, the paper is warm and always slightly curled from the heat, and any delicate fuzzy nap it had before printing has now been flattened. The paper is also now fused to the image it has picked up along the way. I ended the explanation by showing how to change the cartridges, replenish the trays, and pull out mangled pieces of paper from inside the machine. Often during the clearing of a paper jam, I have come away with fingertips dusted grey-black. This is because the image hasn't yet been fused by heat, and so toner is lying softly on the surface, like chalk pastel. Occasionally the transfer is only half there, as the paper didn't make a full turn around the drum, and an incomplete rainbow marks the ragged image edge. In these halted or jammed print jobs, the images are on the page and on my fingers, but also suspended in the air. There are little particles of toner which drift from the open machine onto the ground, or the open flap of door A, or the extended external paper tray. Motes get carried off on my foot, or smudge themselves on the hem of my shirt sleeve. Tiny pieces of images get ferried around the office via an open door, or the breeze created by a fast-walking colleague. In addition to these chance particle images in the air, there are a whole lot more inside the printer itself. Part of the photocopier process involves chance adherence of some, but not all, toner to the paper. Whatever doesn't cling successfully is swept into an internal storage container. Called the waste toner cartridge, this fills up as the other toner cartridges empty themselves out. If you open up the waste toner cartridge, which is not recommended by the manufacturer, it is filled with a dust that seems to hover anxiously. The large amount of dry ink is collected and stored inside, appears as a mid-toned grey-brown-black. It looks this way because it is a mixture of all the colours in the printer, but it is surprising how makeup-like it seems. Vague and neutralish, like the colour of an eyebrow pencil making pretend shadows for real hairs. The toner is dense and yet somehow fluffed, so soft as to be almost imperceptible when you push your finger down into it. My collaborator Ziggy Lever has written previously about the potential for installations to change over time, and that a certain image of an installation takes hold as the authoritative or final one, despite that finality being a kind of fiction. He mentions the making and planning processes, alterations of light or temperature within a space, material transformations of objects, and the individual responses of visitors as examples of what gets lost in the photographic documentation of an exhibition, despite being essential parts of an installation's life cycle. When Lever asks, what traces those materials back to the installation after it disappears? I don't think this is a call for a more exhaustive documentation as evidence of those subtle qualities mentioned above. Rather, I understand the question as an acknowledgement of the flimsiness of the final documentation of an installation, and that despite its authoritative stance, an image's representations have a capacity to be circumvented or interfered with. I use printed matter in installation and sculpture, primarily making multiple publications and ephemera for dispersal, but also as a substrate underneath other parts of a sculpture. This printed matter can be made up from images and texts sourced from historical documents, gathered from online archives, authored by myself, commissioned contemporaneously, or be a combination of those things. Publications in multiple that are free to be taken away by audiences can sometimes be presumed supplementary to an installation, and their looseness and mobility often evades the final, photographically documented when and where of the work. Publications like this operate outside of the type of photographic documentation that fixes an installation's archived image, because they are free to meander, scrunched up in pockets or smoothed flat between the pages of a notebook. If they lack a tether, such as a date, a title, or an artist's name, these publications can also become untraceable, finding themselves amongst other objects and documents, aging at different rates because of exposure to sunlight, used as ad hoc shopping list surfaces. However, thinking about the waste toner cartridge inside the photocopier, I wonder about an even more dissipated when and where for these publications, in particular the images and texts within them, one more on a molecular level than at a scale tangible to the human eye. When does an image solidify? In the photocopier, the answer can be straightforward. The image only adheres to the paper once it passes over and under the heated zone of the roller. It is this particular amalgam of toner which we can call the image, and everything else is just waste to be scraped away. But the waste toner cartridge creates this condition, only through its naming, not because it accurately categorizes the material held within it. To me, these recalcitrant toner particles can be thought of as an extension of the paper-bound image, or maybe like a shadow image. Not solid in any way, and certainly not readable to the human eye, they are instead like pollen or dust in their ability to wander on the air or hitch a ride on a trouser hem. All the particles in the waste toner cartridge had the potential to be part of an image or a piece of text, and it is only chance which determined their fate at the last minute. These particles came into contact with images and texts, yet for whatever reason did not fuse to the paper. Inside the waste toner cartridge, there must be thousands of ghost images and trace texts. They are all bunched up together, intermingled, out of order. There may be more of one ghost image or trace text than another, depending on the amount of copies originally requested or the surface area of toner applied to the drum. So infrequently does the cartridge get replaced that potential pieces of one image from yesterday must be rubbed up next to some particulate from text printed last month or last year. How printed matter is disseminated from within an installation or sculpture is similarly not a one-way street. This dispersal follows a multi-pronged pathway which can be traversed back and forth and which ultimately changes the publication and what is held within them over time. Ephemera from an installation changes hands and locations, becomes archived alongside past exhibition materials, or loses its artistic context entirely. That the constituent materials of printed matter in my practice may also meander off the page before they assemble into a publication draws these multi-pronged pathways back further, charting more whens and wheres that cannot be known. But I can also loop back around even now. In my everyday, I share the photocopier with an identifiable group of co-workers and students. And so it is really the excess toner of their images that my images are coming into contact with. Particles we have each instrumentalized to communicate our interrelated thought processes, drawings and texts are jostled together within the machine like a temporary cosmos, waiting for an errant sleeve to move them into new arrangements or a breeze to disperse them into the air.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
That was Lucy Merle reading Particle Images. Next, you will hear Millie Godfrey reading her contribution, Breathing Room.
Breathing Room. Aerodynamicus was an initiative led by artists Millie Janitas and Nicola Farquhar at Waimari Beach in Ōtautahi on the 22nd of April 2023. There were more than 30 artists from around the Motu involved in making and flying for this event. Coordinates: 43 degrees, 29 minutes, 15 seconds south. 172 degrees, 43 minutes, 29 seconds east. Structure: from the warm sand looking up, a kite is a flitting, tremulous thing. Yet, it requires a sure sense of structural integrity to get up there. The lift of the wind encountering the weight of material, the tail drag balancing the thrust of movement, dart against swoop, swoop after rise, rise becoming fall. This from NASA's webpage. Aerodynamics is the way air moves around things. So, a kite is not just the physical object, the strings and crosses and wings. A kite is how it converses with the wind, or absence thereof. The tension created by the motion of the kite flyer's hands, how fast they run to get it airborne, and how they slow, breathless and attentive, to stand like a puppeteer in dialogue with an extra limb. You could say that the work of artists involves a lot of the stuff of aerodynamics. How do the changeable things, distance, perspective, weather, literally, the effects of the elements on an artwork over time, or how it bears the cultural, social, economic, and political environments which circulate it. Interact with the physical structures of the work itself. The premise of Aerodynamicus seems to call this into focus, elevating these unpredictable factors as an essential part of both the making and sharing of the kites. Like a good poem, which is made not just from the words, but from the shape of the space around them, what emerged from Aerodynamicus was how the kites became more than the structures themselves. Amongst all that space afforded by Waimari Beach, where, on a clear day, you can stand on the shoreline and see the crest of the coastline morph into the jagged Kaikoura ranges, freedom and playfulness emerged. We had our shoes off. The sun burst through unexpectedly, announcing itself to the afternoon. Formalities were shed. There was no structured beginning or end to the event, but rather a trickling and bursting and wavering of participation, as natural and inconsistent as the wind itself. Bridal. A lot of a kite's functionality rests on how successfully the maker has located the fulcrum. The line needs to be placed at the right access point on the bridle, so that the kite can manoeuvre itself against the wind, and so equal strain can be distributed to the right points of the kite. Calculating the length of the bridle is therefore a technical thing, but I imagine the maker's hands are also alive with the memory of the tug and dive of a kite in the air. In a sense, an aerodynamic structure is born out of more than just accurate physics. The kite flyer's construction comes together out of a combination of precision, muscle memory, and hope. But the definition of fulcrum is not just the point on which a lever turns or is supported. It is also the most important part of an activity or a situation. And so it is fitting that the event itself created an exercise out of pinpointing the right coordinates. The webpage for the event had been suitably vague, as had the accompanying Instagram account, which showed a collage of kite inspo, but gave no more insight into the nature of the event. This had caused me to wonder how this would inhibit the very sense of participation that I understood the event to be inviting. And, at first, it seemed it may, with Google Maps taking Arissa and I to outside the Waimari Surf Club, where a few artists with kites peeking out of bags and cardboard boxes had clustered, unsure if it was the right place to be. We waited tentatively. Further down the beach, a larger group had gathered, and eventually someone came to gather us together. Despite the accuracy required in effectively attaching a bridle to a kite in order to get it airborne, many within the artist-cum-kite-flyer group had poured their aroha into the sails and structures of their kites, and so string and scissors were being passed around for those who had not yet attached a bridle and tether. In small clusters, some were making last-minute additions to their kites, swapping lengths of string purchased last minute from the New Brighton hardware store, and advice for flying techniques. The momentum was building, reluctance giving way to curiosity, as one, then two artists took their kites for test runs. And suddenly, there was no shame. Kites were ascending, drooping, crashing, the artists breathless and rather unbridled. Tether. A kite is tethered to a body by a length of string. Sometimes the string appears invisible, so that the kite appears to hang from the sky. Imagine an artwork tethered to the sky rather than the crisp gallery wall. All that breathing room, object, maker, observer, all flapping in the wind. Object, maker, observer, each surrendering to the high chance of elemental damage, giving over to a manner of abandon. Fraught, we'd have to accept that flight might not always be possible. But sometimes, with the right ears, perhaps just enough momentum off the sea or from the friction of the flyer's legs, there'd be a lift.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
That was Millie Godfrey reading Breathing Room. Keep listening to hear Albert L. Raffiti reading Being Social, the context in which the VAR has to embed itself.
Albert Raffiti reading from a chapter in his PhD thesis, Mawai and Tofinga, Spatial Exposition of Samoan Cosmogony and Architecture, 2014. The chapter is titled Being Social, the context in which the VAR has to embed itself. In its traditional Samoan setting, VAR is the organizing principle in which things are given their place and relations are forged between people, as well as between people, objects, space, and territory. As a political agent, it works as a principle of interdependence, a unidirectional relationship between matai and dependence, in which one is meaningless without the other. Serge Jerkosoff points out that in hierarchical societies, peaceful relations of equality and are located within the hierarchy, understood as a space organized by belonging to the same whole. Within that space, there is room for equality at every level. Thus, the movement of power in this context is hierarchical because one of the terms is everything to the other, and the converse is never the case. Samoan society is structured along similar hierarchies that contain different interdependent levels, where each level is meaningless without the other. Persons and objects, for instance, are graded and ranked and given different stations or spheres of relations. Thus, people inherit or are bestowed roles, or tofi, which allow them to sit, nofo, at the center of the circle of matai, made up of ali'i, or paramount chiefs, and tulafale, orator chiefs. Outside the circle are adjunct spheres, made up of tausi, the wives of matai, mirroring the circle of Whamatai, the Awaluma, the unmarried women, and the Aumanga, the untitled men. Va is the glue that folds relationships and interaction into a relational field of actions. As Bradshaw notes, it orders social relations. What is integral to the notion of a person within this sphere of relation is that the person is a distributed entity made up of many parts and connecting lines of relations, and each part can flow from the person to other persons and connecting many in turn. The term tautunanga, or to remember, comes into play here as the call for responsibility and responsiveness to one's relationships, and for honoring one's ancestors and family. One has to maintain many lines of relationships. For subjects in the diaspora, these lines of relations to a Samoan context can become very slack. This is because customary understanding of VAR no longer applies to subjects in the diaspora. Samoans in the diasporas are subjected to laws based on democratic principles of equality in which all subjects have equal access to rights and resources. And by contrast, the Va in the Samoan context keep people within separate and unequal spheres, which are, however, connected and orbit each other. In the diaspora, these spheres are no longer maintained, and the Va as a traditional way to manage an order relationship has gone through successive transformations. To understand the structure of space in Samoan thinking more generally, comparative studies of Samoan concepts and their Western counterparts are useful. For example, in his analysis of the Samoan context of social relations, the anthropologist Brad Shaw notes the absence in Samoa of a verb equivalent to the English verb to be. He points out that an important part of Western thought, by comparison with Samoan thought, is the dichotomy between the real and the apparent. And to quote Shaw, the phenomenal world is interpreted as an array of appearances or seemings and shadows, a veil behind which truth lies as an absolute state beyond both time and space. End of quote. Western thought is distinct from Polynesian thought in its stress of the internal consistency structuring human experience, which reduces the intuition of those non-Western peoples. It seeks to comprehend by turning the possibility of a cross-cultural interpretation into a science. A Samoan understanding of space, as Shaw indicates, takes into account a theory of action rather than one of being, which recognizes the world in its dual aspects, both a transient, mutable, and dynamic aspect, and a stable, immutable, and formal dimension. Both are firmly linked to the phenomenal world, and Shaw believes that, for Samoans, to quote, both aspects of experiences are equally true, for each is appropriated to a different context, and all contexts are linked as complements in actual experience, end of quote. Brad Shaw wrote in the late 1970s and in the early 1980s, and by the 1990s, a greater understanding of space and cultural difference was in full swing. Setha Lowe and Denise Lauren Zuniga, for instance, observe that a renewed interest in issues of space and place in the 1990s foregrounded spatial dimensions of culture rather than treating them as background. To quote, human behavior was now seen as being located in and constructive of space, end of quote. This renewed interest in space perpetuate assumptions about globalized space and promoted a divided view of the nature of space itself and of the relation between space and society. To quote, space and society mapped onto each other, and together they were from the beginning divided up. Cultures, societies, and nations were all imagined as having an integral relation to bounded spaces. Internally coherent and differentiated from each other by separation, end of quote. Places as location of cultural identity came to be seen as bounded, with their own internal generated authenticities and defined by their difference from other places beyond their borders. Doreen Massey proposes that this imagined space is a way to organize global space as divided, regionalized, so that the nation-state as a project could be legitimated as progress, as natural across the globe. Akhil Gupta and James Ferguson call this the isomorphism of space, place, and culture, using the example of how the Bushmen came to be Bushmen. They argue that instead of assuming the autonomy of the primeval community, and to quote them, we need to examine how it was formed as a community out of the interconnected space that always already existed, end of quote. They propose that a shared historical process differentiates and connects the world. Debates in the Pacific and elsewhere suggest that received categories and authenticities need to be questioned, and that the current assumptions of remoteness and isolation have been produced both discursively and materially through colonialism. Anthropologists and social scientists in general may have adopted a lens of local studies, imagining themselves to have found primitive isolates. They defined them as place-defined societies and assumed that they were pre-capitalist originals. Massey regards space as a product of dynamic interrelations, connections and disconnections, and their combined effects, an emergent product of relations. This would include relations which establish boundaries, where place is necessarily meeting place. In such cases, difference of a place must be conceptualized predominantly as the constant emergence of, to quote, uniqueness out of and within the specific constellation of interrelations, within which a place is set, but also what is made of that constellation, end of quote. In the rationalized project of modernity, spaces and cultures are differentiated into temporal sequences in which Western Europe is advanced, other parts of the world some way behind, yet others are backwards. The transformation of the world geography into world history renders spatial heterogeneity as a single temporal series, and thereby reduces cultural difference to that between places within a historical queue. Scientific studies of other cultures turns out to be a process of distancing, in which the subject of study is separated from the object by history, and the object of study becomes distant from the subject's scientific gaze. This distancing has the effect, to quote, of decreasing the actuality of difference, because difference or heterogeneity is neatly packed into its bounded spaces and dismissed to the past, or to dismiss from our past, end of quote. Massey proposes that a more useful way to identify the world of the others is to treat history as a simultaneous event. She uses the notion of coevalness, an imaginative space of engagement that mutually implicates identity, space, and time in the construction of a space of complexity and multiplicity. The end of modernity not only heralds the arrival of the margins at the center, but also the arrival of people from the past. Distance is suddenly eradicated, both spatially and temporally, and migration is an assertion of coevalness, and to quote Massey, the repression of the spatial was bound up with the establishment of foundational universals, and vice versa. The repression of the possibility of multiple trajectories and the denial of the real difference of others was what at issue was the establishment of a geography of power, knowledge, end of quote. And it was in this context, in the mid-1990s, that Albert Wendt's reimagining of the VAR took place. The subject of such times as a body becoming, to quote Al Wendt, created a va by clearing a space for itself among and alongside other bodies. The crux of the reinvention of the va at this moment is that it must provide a space of equality, where a proper engagement between Samoans and, by extension, the other Pasifika community and people of the new land could take place. An engagement based on respect, te ulu va, and in this sense, te ulu va become the possibility of existing and engaging with others on the same level by bringing things into relation, and by doing so, exist as equal. This would be the ideal of coevalness that Fabian and Massey conceptualize, which allows the native other to exist spatially and temporally on the same plane with modern subject.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
That was Albert L. Raffetti reading Being Social, the context in which the va has to embed itself. And that's it for this episode of Art Not Science. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to a selection of readings from Correspondence Issue 2.2. The next issue of Correspondence will be launching next month. Go to the Physics Room website for updates on our events page or via social media for more information. Our current exhibition, My Throat, A Shelter, is an exhibition of two new experimental films by Selena Ershadi and James Tapsell Kururangi. The exhibition is situated in embodied and intangible systems of knowledge, with the artists drawing on family narratives documented in home videos, oral histories, portents, and screen histories. Catch it at the Physics Room until Sunday, the 10th of December. Our annual Physics Room fundraiser returns, launching on Tuesday the 12th of December from 5 p.m. This year's fundraiser will feature a range of works from our 2023 exhibition program artists and other past legends. Proceeds from each sale will be split 50-50 with the 2023 contributing artists. The rest will go directly into our 2024 program, with the goal to cover one whole exhibition project. The 2023 fundraiser includes original paintings, photographic prints, collages, and sculptures by artists Dan Arps, Megan Brady, Sam Clagg, Turumiki Harrington, Priscilla Rose Howe, Anna Iti, Miranda Parks, Zena Swanson, and Tyrone Tewa. The fundraiser includes works at a range of price points, starting at $100. With the intention to provide an opportunity for our wider community to acquire original artworks at a more affordable price. The fundraiser continues from the 13th till the 16th of December, at which point the gallery will be closed until next year, reopening with our first show of 2024 on the 1st of February. Thank you for listening. Tune in next month on Friday the 15th of December at 8 p.m. for our next episode of Art Not Science.
The Physics Room is generously supported by Creative New Zealand, the Christchurch City Council, the Rata Foundation, Three Boys Brewery, Scientech, and the Crater Rim.